You're tuned to 90.3 FM WZBC. My name is John Grebe. We bring you this program every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., Sounds of Dissent. Gary Loop is a professor of history at Tufts University here in the Boston area and adjunct professor of comparative religion. Gary Loop joins us. He's a frequent contributor to the political journal Counterpunch. You can find his articles at counterpunch.org. Welcome to the program, Gary Loop.
Great to be here.
Gary, let me start out by asking you about a recent article of yours that appeared in Counterpunch, One More Neocon Target, South Korea. You point out that one would expect North Korea to remain on the short list of targeted countries that the Bush administration has drawn up, but now the longtime United States ally South Korea seems to be drawing the attention of the group of neoconservatives, as they're known, the Project for the New American Century, and its members, including its one of its board chairs, William Crystal, who puts out the weekly standard conservative political magazine.
Yes.
South Korea.
Yes, I thought it was quite ironic that South Korea would be confronted with this kind of hostile treatment. But it actually does make a kind of sense. The gist of the piece was that the current regime in Seoul, which came to power in an election in 2002, is not satisfactorily hostile to the North and not sufficiently cooperating with the Bush administration agenda for regime change in North Korea. And so what William Crystal did was to send out to opinion makers a memo essentially saying we can't work with this no Moo-hyun regime and that we should go over the government, over the heads of the government, which is dominated by left-wing radicals. That's essentially the way he depicts them, in order to appeal to that component of the Korean population which opposes that government. So essentially he's asking for, with William Crystal citing an American Enterprise Institute economist by the name of Eberstadt, Nicholas Eberstadt, essentially what they're calling for is a type of regime change in South Korea.
It's a time when the Bush administration has been changing a lot of its own cabinet members, some resigning, many having resigned in protest, and the Bush administration now replacing some. The Bush administration seems to believe that it can suggest, while it's doing the rest of the game, to replace other people around the world, and having already replaced Saddam Hussein or removed him from power, the replacement isn't quite finished yet. But we're seeing in North Korea and South Korea, United States policy toward both of them, the United States also sort of naming North Korea on its short list. I don't know whether it's been literally dubbed an evil axis.
Yes, it's part of the axis of evil. It's one of the original three.
And along with Iran.
Iran and Iraq. It's just a highly implausible trio of countries that have little connection with one another. But that's the first tier of targets. And then below that, according to John Bolton, a major figure in the State Department under Colin Powell, but not a Powell ally, rather a neocon representative within the State Department, otherwise not really amenable so much to the neocon agenda. But John Bolton has specifically declared Syria, Cuba, Sudan, at one point Libya, although that's been taken off the list, and a number of countries is also targeted for regime change. But that's been known for a couple of years. What's interesting to me is that the list keeps getting expanded, even into some very unlikely countries, such as South Korea. When I read that memo, I thought, the neocons are really pushing their luck and expressing a kind of arrogance about what the United States government can do in the world. And so I wanted to draw people's attention to that.
It's quite an important topic. We focused a bit in the past on the Project for the New American Century and its members. The Bush administration is full of them, affiliates to the Project for the New American Century. I wonder if you could help me take a look at some of them, but they would include Paul Wolfowitz, Dick Cheney, Douglas Feith, and others in the Bush administration.
Scooter Libby.
Mm-hmm.
John Bolton, Elliot Abrams. There's about a dozen of them. And the definition of neoconservative is a little bit problematic. I would recommend going to the Christian Science Monitor website, where they have a nice little article or collection of mini-biographies called Neocons 101. And they apply a certain definition of what constitutes a neocon. A broader definition would include Rumsfeld and Cheney, maybe Bush. But the general description of a neocon, according to the Christian Science Monitor, is a group of Democrats, liberal Democrats, who by the end of the Vietnam War, or the end of the 1960s at least, had come to the conclusion that the anti-war faction within the Democratic Party had taken control of the party. So they defected to the Republican Party, where they became very influential subsequently in the Reagan administration. So they identify with the Republican Party without very enthusiastically endorsing its domestic conservative package, but they have used Republican administrations to promote their own very aggressive foreign policy. And initially that took the form of challenging the CIA assessment of the strength of the Soviet Union, which they felt was a minimalistic assessment. They emphasized the need to massively build up American military strength to confront the Soviet Union.
Let me ask you a little bit about the context of this development of neocons, neoconservatives, neoconservatism, and what they believe, which was easy to ignore before 2000, before so many of them ascended into the presidential administration of the United States.
Right.
Foreign policy is traditionally examined, probably oversimplified, into two categories, realpolitik, or realism, and the other known as the liberal side of pursuing foreign policy, liberalism. And these terms, of course, also bear almost zero relation to the term liberal or reality as they're commonly used even in domestic politics in the United States.
Right.
Do you see neoconservatism and its advocacy of unlimited, unbridled United States power verging on empire, as we've witnessed, and no longer trying to just contain what some might conceive as modern threats facing the United States, no longer just contain them, but preempt them? In other words, attack before being attacked. Is this a kind of a watershed?
I think so, and I think that the way that they define their own project is a smokescreen. I really don't believe that they themselves thought that Iraq posed a threat to the United States. Indeed, Wesley Clark, soon after 9/11, in talking with colleagues at the Pentagon that he knew very well for many years, concluded, and he mentions this in his book and in his Rolling Stone interview, that the the Bush administration officials promoting an attack on Iraq didn't seriously believe it constituted a threat to the United States, but as he put it, they felt that at some point it might constitute a nuclear threat to Israel. So what's being said in terms of the publicly digested explanations for U.S. policy and the real motivations are quite different. My own sense of things, the broad picture, is that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was quite unexpected for most of us a dozen years ago, and the emergence of this unipolar world, there was one faction centering around the neocons, of course, who were out of power during the Clinton administration, which corresponds to most of the post-war era, who were saying, let's make use of this opportunity, where we have no real military challenge, to move in and establish our hegemony over parts of the world where we can during this window of opportunity. And then there was the Clinton administration policy, which was more the real politic and engage in diplomacy and don't alienate the world through unilateral action. But the neocons came to power with the first Bush election. And I think that the way that they are seeing Southwest Asia is like this. Here's a collection of states that are quite disparate. Afghanistan, Iran, Syria, Iraq. They're not unified. They're very different. Some secular, some religious, and so on. None with alliances with outside powers that would be a threat to U.S. intervention. So there's an opportunity to simply move in using various pretexts to establish a U.S. empire for the new American century. And if the United States can accomplish that, that means that in future, should there be friction with Europe or Japan or China, the U.S. will be able to say, look, we sit here on top of all of this oil, and we have all these military bases strung out here in this region between China and Europe. We're in an unassailable position. That's how I see the New American Century Project.
Gary Loop is on the line with us, professor of history at Tufts University and adjunct professor of comparative religion. He's a frequent contributor to the political journal Counterpunch. If you're looking for his material, the last name is L-E-U-P-P, Gary Loop. Gary Loop, let me switch the topic a little bit right now to ask you a bit about, before we get to talk about elections around the world, let's talk a little bit about the Ukraine and as it relates a bit to this neoconservative domination agenda or sort of U.S. hegemony in power in global politics. We could note that the press has been examining essentially the Ukraine from a perspective primarily of the way that the vote, the election, had fraudulent results, or that there was fraud during the election, and the results are invalid. And that's essentially the primary focus of most of the coverage we're seeing about the Ukraine and the recent election. You've asserted that this has developed into a clash between the United States and Russia, between President Bush and Vladimir Putin. But you say it's not actually freedom versus dictatorship. It's not capitalism versus whatever Jeffrey Sachs replaced apparent communism with, which wasn't real communism anyway. Right. But it's something else entirely. What is that?
As I see it, the contest that's being depicted in much of the press, I shouldn't say all the mainstream press, the British press is essentially treating this as a conflict between two powers as opposed to an electoral mess. As I see it, the issue is not whether Viktor Yanukovych, the government-promoted candidate, or Viktor Yushchenko, the U.S.-backed candidate, got more votes. But the real issue is the future of the Ukraine, which is a country of 48 million people. Aside from Russia, it's the most populated country, or excuse me, the largest, geographically largest country in Europe. And it has a very large population, very productive, agriculturally and industrially. The question is whether this country joins NATO and becomes entrenched in the expanding U.S.-NATO camp, or whether it maintains what has been for 1,000 years a special relationship with Russia, to which it is ethnically and linguistically very much attached. As the Soviet Union collapsed, or even before the formal collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, Russia and Belarus and the Ukraine established a kind of confederation which became the nucleus of the CIS. And the economic links between them, the cultural links, are very profound. So Vladimir Putin wants to maintain that relationship and strengthen it, and has been doing so with some very positive results, at least in terms of the economy, for the Ukraine. But the U.S. would like to detach Ukraine from Russia, and towards that end has pumped millions of dollars into the electoral process. George Soros, who was very involved in regime change in Georgia, as well as U.S. taxpayer-funded foundations, have been involved in promoting Yushchenko's campaign, with the expectation that he would win, and should he not win, the foregone conclusion to be touted in the press is that there was massive vote fraud, followed by hundreds of thousands of orange-clad Yushchenko adherents out in the streets. It makes it look like a real uprising here is beginning and inevitably is going to produce regime change in the Ukraine.
Let me ask a little bit about the background of democratic elections, which you've also written about. At this time in the United States, where people's faith in democratic elections is under some challenge, I think, it's interesting, you note that years ago, someone said faith in democratic elections in class-divided societies, and we should note that the United States has perhaps never seen quite so much class division, at least in its recent history, as there is right now. The rich have been getting richer and the poor have been getting poorer for decades, and real wages have been declining, adjusted for current dollar terms, since the 1970s. For the vast majority of people in our society, where we all are marketed to purchase security, these are my words, not yours, but to purchase security, I think, in the form of outward representations of wealth and comfort and security, even while we are being driven further into credit card debt, into debt in general, and being made less secure. So I just place this quote in that context, that faith in democratic elections in class-divided societies as parliamentary cretinism, which holds its victims spellbound in an imaginary world and robs them of all sense, memory, and understanding of the rough external world.
That's a quotation from the mid-19th century from Karl Marx, following an election in France in 1848, a very interesting historical episode. In February of that year, the working class of Paris had ousted the monarchy and established a provisional government, which, among other things, abolished slavery and established a 10-hour work day, which was considerably shorter than what had pertained earlier, and established government-sponsored workshops to set the unemployed to work and so on, and also planned for an election which would involve universal male suffrage. This is the first time in history that there had been such an election, not only in France, but in Britain and the United States. 100% adult male voter participation. And when the vote took place in the summer, it meant a big setback for the progressives, because the peasantry, now with the franchise, was so molded by the churches, by the advice of the priests, to vote for conservative forces, that they're the ones who came to power, promptly disestablished the workshops, and promptly ended universal male suffrage. So my point in that piece, and Marx's point, in one of his points in his assessment, was that just because you have a democratic election in which formally people can go and put ballots in ballot boxes doesn't necessarily contribute to human liberation at all. One has to look at the surrounding forces, those who create public opinion, those who have the wealth to publish pamphlets, or in the modern period to own television stations and newspapers, and to create the way that people look at the world.
Gary Loop is my guest. He's professor of history at Tufts University in Medford, and a frequent contributor to the political newsletter Counterpunch. That's actually available in printed biweekly newsletter form, and also on the World Wide Web, a tremendous resource of authors contributing from around the world at counterpunch.org. In this article, Gary Loop, that you have on Counterpunch recently, The Wrong Side Wins, Democratic Elections in Historical Perspective, you take a look at all of this that we've been discussing. And I wonder, in particular, if we focus a little bit more on the United States and the history of elections and class conflict. And I know that we don't often discuss, you know, our public school United States history courses, we don't discuss class conflict so very frequently in so many public schools around the country, and it's not a topic that is commonly discussed, although it is in the rest of the world. But the United States is currently in a position of unparalleled power, beyond superpower status. Some call it, in foreign policy terms, a hyperpower now. We have no other rival superpower. Economically, the United States has tremendous muscle, although internally there's a lot of economic conflict. Anyway, it's in a condition of conflict between different economic classes, most people, of course, being much poorer, a few middle-class people, and a tiny 1 to 5%, however you want to cut it up and look at it and label it upper class. I wonder how historically has elections essentially been either influenced or reflected this sort of stark class divide?
Well, I'm not an American historian, so I can't respond in with specifics.
Yeah.
About the process over time, but I think the main point that one should think about is the construction of public opinion itself, because people can march to the polls thinking, I'm going to use my democratic right here, and I'm going to participate. But if they're going to the polls with a perception of the world which is bogus, then what is the point? There are democratic elections, or there are elections anyway, that are called democratic all over the place. In Latin America, the U.S. State Department considers every country a democracy now, except for Cuba. And so in a Central American country in which a vote takes place involving more than one party, say two parties, in a context where various parties are banned, various newspapers are banned, discussion of certain things is not possible. Squads of armed men intimidate voters. Nevertheless, that's considered a democracy because people went and they went through this ritual of inserting a ballot into a box.
I'm moved to mention what H.L. Mencken said, that the whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed and hence clamorous to be led to safety by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary.
I think that's very much true now, and I think it was true during much of the Cold War, and that we had a kind of lapse for a while in which there wasn't a high panic level among the population. But after 9/11, there was an opportunity to really exploit that, and I think the Bush administration has done it very skillfully. With such things as the color-graded
alert level. The rainbow of alert.
Yes. Yes.
We can have a diversity rainbow of alerts.
But the danger there is that if you cry wolf too often, you get people scared, and then it turns out that they really didn't need to be so scared. If you get them to think that Iraq might produce a mushroom cloud over New York, and then it turns out there are no weapons of mass destruction, then people might become contemptuous, and a lot of them might come to the conclusion that the whole political process is worthless, and so not participate at all. And that works in a way for the, in this case, the Bush administration, but in the long term, the spread of contempt for the system can be very dangerous for them.
Gary Loop, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but thank you so much for joining us today on Sounds of Dissent.
Thank you for having me.
Gary Loop is professor of history at Tufts University and adjunct professor of comparative religion. He's a frequent contributor to Counterpunch Political Journal. If you're looking for his work online, the last name is L-E-U-P-P, Gary Loop. You're tuned to Sounds of Dissent on WZBC in Newton, 90.3 FM. My name is John Green.